We're working in New Bedford in the 19th century. I'm glad you didn't turn around. In the period of the whaling. And it's very exciting, but I never wanted to do it, but I find that getting more and more into it, it's totally fascinating. This is a building that's part of the historic district. It belongs to the Waterfront Historic Area League, and it's a fantastic concept of what was happening between 1800 and 1900 in New Bedford, an urban situation which I'm totally unused to, which completely exhausts me. It's very exciting. Mm-hmm. I find it's very challenging. I still find that I just get completely drawn back into, like, this house here, which is where I really feel a whole bunch of stuff that's real, because it's before the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. And it's where the people were really touching and handcrafting and relating to a more truer sense of life than perhaps the whaling industry, which was very, very real and very true, but very fast and very hard and very beginning before we're getting into what we're in now, the 20th century of push-push. And,
yes, actually, the peak of the whaling industry was mid-19th century, wasn't it?
Right. Mm-hmm. And this building was built as a warehouse in 1818. It's known as the Macomber Sylvia Building, and it's 71 Union Street, and it was then later changed. The facade was changed to pure Victorian when all that Victorian architecture was moving into to New Bedford, and the guy who owned it must have felt like he wanted to get on the bandwagon of identification, the social trip, or what have you, mm-hmm. in his business. And he raised the building up 3 feet and put on this, what is now a very beautiful facade, but you can just see it was a big hustle. But it's kind of fun to work with, because you can kind of see also that he was influenced by what had been before him and by the whaling industry, which is very exciting, and the concept of what he was doing to help the whole trade that was going on in New Bedford. So from that point, it is fascinating.
Yes. Well, it isn't your first love. You get into it. Isn't that the way it is, Anne? You get into something, and you somehow find yourself involved.
Very involved.
Yes.
Right. You get involved with the reasons, the whys, the wherefores, the people you try to feel. And actually, you can do it. You know, you kind of can shed the 1976 cars zooming by and the trucks and the noise, and you sort of fall back into a time in history. And you mm-hmm. really do. Mm-hmm. You begin to feel the atmosphere and the people, and then you can kind of feel the structure and begin to get a structure that I didn't particularly like, you begin to fall in love with, because you feel responsible to it, mm-hmm. and you can feel that it had stood there and been through all this stuff. So you kind of treat it like, it's
150 years old.
Right. So you figure the least you can do is respect it for that and give it another 150 to 200 years.
I want to give this house 500 years if I can.
Right, absolutely. It deserves it.
Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking, too, about this involvement, watching you work over at the Cogswell House this summer, looking at every little thing that came out of the dust. And I taped Arlene Gifford the other day, and she brought out photographs, absolutely perfectly beautiful photographs of the Cogswell House the way it was in 1850 or something like that, with hollyhocks at the door, the roof perfect, the sides in perfect condition, a lovely picket fence, before they had rented it to these people who didn't take care of it, when her family had, her great-grandmother lived in it, mm-hmm. and before then, other people lived in it. So it's gone through a lot, and then it collapsed. And that's what I want. You want to keep this from doing, and it's just in time, isn't it, down there at the waterfront?
In time is what?
In time, if it had gone much longer.
It was already shot. In fact, what it was various people in the area felt that the building had no hope, mm-hmm. because I don't think they understood the meaning of wood and what hope it does have. Mm-hmm. And they figured that they could buy it and condemn it.
Mm-hmm.
And Whale felt that if by going ahead and having some imagination, if they did fix it up, then whoever bought it couldn't condemn it, because it would then be structurally sound. So
yes.
Basically,
that's what you're doing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's great, you know, because, think of the places. Think of the Waite Potter house that fell down up here.
And the Congstall house.
And the Congstall house. Yes. Actually, perhaps even 25 years ago,
absolutely,
the Congstall house mm-hmm. might have been saved. Mm-hmm. Well, you yourself have moved buildings and remodeled them, your own house. Tell us about a little bit about how you
started. Yeah, I like to have that going with it. That house is known as the James Tripp House, and it was located just a little bit north and closer to Drift Road. And it was moved in, I think it was 70, doesn't matter, 97, somewhere in there. And then the addition onto it was moved from Westport Point, and before that had been moved from Fisher Road to Westport Point, so it's been moved three times.
Mm-hmm.
And the other buildings there came from a combination of Dartmouth, Peyton Arrow, Chepachet, Rhode Island, Marshfield, Mass., and forgotten what they call it, but it's just west of Providence, Rhode Island. And the house itself...
Kingston?
What?
Kingston or something like that?
No, it's...
a little place. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. It's just west of Rhode Island, Providence,
mm-hmm.
Near Johnston.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them just completely perfect to... just so much good wood in them. And,
mm-hmm.
and they were all going to be demolished or
mm-hmm.
Somehow ruined so that by doing this, not only did they get saved, but they also have very good uses.
Yes.
Being put to good use. But
the relationships, the way you've made them, is beautiful. I think these little buildings out here have a nice relationship, too. I'm anxious for you to see them in the daylight.
Right, just driving in, it looked like they did. I
mm-hmm.
haven't seen them right. But the James Tripp House is interesting because, again, I go on record, having been told this, that John Goddard was born in that house.
Oh, really?
His mother was Mary Tripp, who was James Tripp's daughter, and she must have come home to have him, although the Goddards moved to Portsmouth. There's one other indication of a Goddard in town that I could find, and his name was Beriah Goddard, and he lived either, you know that great greenhouse that's near the high school?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's
that
called.
That's it's a Gifford house.
Yeah, and at some point it was a
salt box.
At some point it was a, not the courthouse, but there was some...
He was a judge, and it was the jail.
It was a jail?
They kept... I mean, he kept... anybody who was sentenced stayed there overnight.
Well, either on that property or the property next to it, and I couldn't figure out just where the bounds ended, was the only other Goddard I could find in town. So they must have been here before they went to Portsmouth. But
mm-hmm.
The Goddards moved to Portsmouth, to Newport, and... they were carpenter housewives.
I know.
Yeah.
Made all
and
this beautiful furniture
yeah,
with the
John
ball
Goddard's father
and golf
died that by slipping off a roof. He was shingling the roof or something.
Uh-huh.
That's what I hear. But that's the only record of the Goddards in this town. It's Brian Goddard and John Goddard being born here. So he must have been here for a little bit of time. But, okay, this is good. I want to put this on record so somebody can challenge it. As I do this research,
mm-hmm.
sort of like southern Massachusetts across to... this is a new thing, a
mm-hmm.
development, an idea. Across through Portsmouth, a little bit down towards South County in Rhode Island,
mm-hmm.
I find that the architecture, the early architecture, stone enders,
mm-hmm.
what we call Rhode Island stone
yes.
enders, but we find them here, the Waite Potter House,
mm-hmm.
the stone enders, kind of follows through the same vein that the Quakers moved, not because the Quakers were building houses to look alike, but because they obviously had their trade. Somebody was influencing their trade and knew how to build houses. And I don't know yet, but I have a feeling that there's some connection.
That's interesting.
Yeah, the house we took down in Portsmouth, which was known as the Adam Mott House, was Adam Mott was one of the first founders in Newport in Portsmouth in 1634.
Hmm.
And he was a freeman, and he was... came from Hingham, Mass., and moved down there, and within a short time, Quaker religion dates back to the later part of the 17th century.
Mm-hmm.
When George Fox came
yes,
over from
yes.
England.
I'm a Quaker.
Okay.
And
George
I'm
Fox
Fox
preached in this house, right,
mm-hmm.
that we dismal in Portsmouth, and it was the main part of the house, fantastic house, was a stone ender.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I keep picking this up, and you know, George Watts's, Adam Watts's son, Jacob, came over and established the Aponogastic Church here in So, and then we have some stone enders here, and you get them as far as Fairhaven, maybe further, I don't know yet. And you get them, you know. So I don't know. I question this. And I don't know if anybody else has done any research.
No, I think you're going into a lot of things much more deeply than anyone else has.
No, not more deeply. There are those of us who are really...
Are you?
No, I'm not unique.
You're not alone.
No.
No. I was just thinking, what about this Mr. Hauk who's come? Is he connected only with Hauk?
Oh, Tom.
Tom.
Yeah.
Wait. The reason I'm asking you, whereas in the beginning people just kind of did it because they had money and so on, now it's changing.
Well, I think, like in any culture, people who are cultured, they appreciate fine arts, they appreciate the finer, they have time to appreciate things that perhaps might cost money and other people don't have the time or are not interested or haven't had the opportunity, the education, or what have you. And I think that there have been in the past, thank God, many people who have taken a house, turned it into a museum, or their historical society or something, but which is great.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think that they had no concept, really, except for their own little group that was a neat thing and that felt good and so on, what the meaning of what they were really doing and how the influence or how what they were doing was going to influence other people. And then, the other side of it, suddenly the responsibility behind what they were doing, which then meant they no longer could be just doing this after-hours cocktail party sort of time, but that it was serious. And they had taken on stuff that a lot of people... It was our history. And
I mean, our history is there. It isn't in the word that in this book or that. It's out there, wherever it is.
And there's so much that people, I suppose because we haven't had time until, as it's time is given us, to, leisure time is given us, to really spend time and think about a lot of the meanings or care about a lot of the meanings of where we came from to the extent that we do now because of Plasticville or what have you. Wait a minute, turn off for a second. I've got one more to say for a second. Sliding on stuff that other people have said. For many, many years, we've accepted it, and it's been our tool, and we haven't questioned it, really. Now, because as each year goes by, more and more of our heritage becomes rarer, I think that we're trying to understand better, really, what it is. It's not just a matter of writing a book and saying, hey, this is what they did in 1690 or something. I think we feel a responsibility to record it correctly, but to understand it also. And I think that's very important for us, too, because I think we're trying to relate to who the heck we are today.
Yes.
And the values of where we've come from in order to...
We certainly don't know who we are most of the time today.
That's for sure. Yeah. But I respect the fact that there are many people now who are deeply trying to learn this as a scholar. They are traveling to England, they are taking, I mean, there are courses now, extensive, very, very complete and good courses. People are going back and rechecking a lot of the information that they thought and wrote in books and so on, and trying to change it and update it and correct it. And through our archaeological, and that's one of the reasons that I was really interested in, we haven't had enough yet time to make enough digs to correlate how people were really living in the different centuries by what we find in the digs with the architectural structures. And the combination of those two things will tell us a great deal about the average person. That's what we're after.
Yes.
Because that's what we all are.
Yes.
We have diaries on George Washington. We know how certain people lived and what they ate and what they thought and so on. But the average, everyday person, which all of us are, we do not really, we know so little about that person and what his desires were and what he, why he got up in the morning, what he was really after. And I think our architecture, if we understand it and study it correctly, and our the the artifacts that we find that go along with it, and the accumulation of these that we'll begin to be able to read into them social changes that come through various periods changing in standards of life due to new discoveries, wars, what have you.
Mm-hmm. You think, in other words, that here in New England or here in the United States, we may make a unique contribution to archaeology and our anthropology by really finding out, since we are a democracy and care about the common man and not necessarily just about the pharaoh or the king or the courtier or something, that we may make a whole new contribution to the study of history all over the world.
Yeah,
You know, because they've been, of course, in Persia or whatever, been studying, I mean,
people
for
are
generations.
Always looking for freedom, and people came here looking for another way out, another type of freedom, and I think very quickly society amongst people, the demands it puts on, they begin to lose that initial pure feeling that they're after, although sometimes I wonder if I know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
You know?
Well,
whether it's just a romanticized idea in my mind, although it's...
I don't think it is. I think you've really put something forward here, and probably you and all the people you're working with are thinking this. As you say, you're not alone in it. What we were interested in Egypt was the pharaoh, mm-hmm. you know, and all his little group of cohorts, mm-hmm. and people who had pots of money and who could hire slaves and so on, but we weren't interested in the slave.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And now, here, in this country of ours, if we're not interested in the slave, we can't be democratic.
That's right, never thought of that.
Well, is that that's what I thought you were saying, that the common man...
The common man is this country.
Yes.
The common man then needs certain leaders.
Mm-hmm.
He knows right from the beginning, after you had created communes. The commune is not a new thing. I mean, a bunch of people got together and they figured out who's gonna build the common road for all of them, mm-hmm. and have the common where they could keep their animals or mm-hmm. what have you, because
just
man
like the Boston
knows
Congress.
He has to work with other people, but our government, our democracy, falls back into a very basic need amongst people. But we all are individuals, but we need to have help from other people, and we need to have those who can guide us, who know more about something, do that for us. But very quickly it gets out of hand, and we lose track of really the simplicity of what we want, and I don't know that there's a... maybe that's inevitable in all cases. But I think perhaps by our interest now in our history, because we have time to do it, is perhaps searching for that meaning, that simplicity, and that individuality. I think that's one of the things that we've lost more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Our ability to go out and look at the sky and say, hey, it's going to rain in 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, we go to the radio to find out the weather.
Well, yes.
And that's a frightening thing, to lose touch with our own selves and our own common sense, our own ability to make a judgment. And I think that we all somewhere subtly feel this, and that's why I think there's a interest in getting back in touch with an old house, for instance, or old furniture, because we know that one person made it, a machine didn't make it.
Nice.
And there's something that comes through, or at least we hope we're going to find an answer.
Yes.
To get back to our own individuality, mm-hmm. and away from mediocrity, which is what we're being put into in this century.
Yes, we certainly are. And, well, there's no love involved in it. It's a job, and it's 8 hours a day, or 7 or 6 or 5, and we're getting it whittled down. Whereas in the 19th century, time didn't mean the same thing. I mean, if you liked what you were doing, if you were working with wood and liked it, it didn't matter how long you were working.
That's right. That is love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's love.
Although then that, too, could be a romanticized idea, because sometimes I wonder when I say my feelings, whether certain people who lived 200 years ago are rolling over in their graves and saying, oh, babe, if you only knew how I hate it.
Oh, you know? I don't believe
because
they did, really.
Because the other side of that is that all the time man is trying to improve himself.
Yes.
Which is what's brought us to where we are now.
That's
so
true.
There is that, too.
Yes.
And so even though he understood the piece of wood, that chair that he was carving,
mm-hmm.
he at the same time was thinking, how can I make this so that the second chair I make, I can do faster?
Mm-hmm.
And
but I think he also may have been saying, too, something else, and that is, how can I do better? I don't think speed.
I don't know.
Maybe I don't know.
Okay, I find that in my studying, which I'm getting more and more into, just plain joints
mm-hmm.
in houses,
mm-hmm.
that in the 15th century, up through the middle of the 16th century, the joinery system, let's say for building houses,
mm-hmm.
The major timber
mm-hmm.
joint systems,
mm-hmm.
had reached their height of sophistication, and that the craftsman reached a point where he really understood the wood, the stresses on the wood, and how to refine his joint to get the most out of the two pieces of wood that were going to be connected, because
mm-hmm.
he didn't have nails, so he had
mm-hmm.
to use mortise and tenons,
yes.
right? Shortly after the middle of the 16th century, the joints began to degress. Okay, the
mm-hmm.
reason being that it was beginning to cost more money
mm-hmm.
to pay somebody or to be paid to do it. So that's way back then. It all
then
started,
it all started
right.
to be, yes.
Right.
Well.
And when you look at the...
well, this is every civilization, isn't it, in a way? For instance, early Greece was so much more honest, direct, devoted, and so on than late Greece.
Mm-hmm.
Early Egypt was so much more sturdy, earthy, wonderful, beautiful, everything than late
mm-hmm.
Egypt.
But why? What happens along the way when man gets greedy? That's what happens.
That's what I right. think happens.
Yes.
He gets greedy.
Right. Mm-hmm. So he does look at that chair, and not only does he say,
well,
hey, how can
I make
the second
one
better?
I don't know whether it's the same man
better.
That does it, but another man comes along and wants to get more money. But I think
even the guy who's making that chair, unless he's doing it just as a special
hobby
or
for fun.
It,
but,
right,
but if
he's
laboring.
He's thinking, how can I make this faster,
mm-hmm.
just as well, but faster.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that starts happening, he's going to figure out how to make it faster, because that's how we have the machines and methods that we have today, because it's a progression of this kind of thinking. He's going to lose that little bit of touch of his own sweat and blood in
yes.
that chair.
And let's go to Goddard. And thinking of him as a furniture maker now, and a carpenter, and so on, he developed... I mean, in England, Chippendale made ball and claw feet and so on, and beautiful things, but no Englishman ever had the directness and honesty and integrity that Goddard had, in his work with, let's say, the patterns or whatever it was, the books that he had that were the Chippendale. And he devised this little...
He was a free man. He had one
a free thing.
Thing.
And then he devised this little freestanding claw on the ball of the foot and a whole lot of things that make one recognize a Goddard piece whenever one sees it.
Mm-hmm.
And they are beautiful. Do you think his work deteriorated as he grew older?
I don't know enough about his work.
I think it'd be interesting to
yeah.
really look at it right. that way. I have a book back
that
here.
That you related him to certain work that's being done in a foreign country in Europe, because perhaps he was able to create better because he was a free man and
mm-hmm.
he did not have the political influences bearing on him. But I think that today we have those political influences.
Yes.
One of the reasons that he came here, or his family did, was to get away from that,
mm-hmm.
and we're getting right back into...
We certainly are. Quicker and quicker.
I'm going to go to the moon next.
Yes. Yes. Tell me, you say you were not born in Westport.
No, Rhode Island. I think very strongly Rhode Island.
You're Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm. From way
where did you... What about your education?
Well, I grew up in Providence, and I went to school there, and then I went away to boarding school,
mm-hmm.
and went to 1 year of college and was married.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Now, when you were in school, were you interested in art? I can remember I was always in a dye pot or a paint pot or something from very early on.
I grew up using my hands,
mm-hmm.
Mostly with wood, just mm-hmm. doing dumb things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody kept saying to me, come on, you gotta get out of the workshop and go to the beach or go
yes.
to a party or something.
Yes.
I didn't have too much guidance, but I just liked it.
I stayed away. I mean, everybody was doing something or going to a party, and then I would have a headache and would be sitting making a painting or a woodblock or reading a book.
Yeah. But at the same time, my sister, who was 2 years older than I was very popular, and I kept thinking, wow, why aren't I popular? You know,
yes.
Two cross-sections
yes.
and one not wanting to be anywhere with these people and then wondering how come there weren't people.
Well, don't. Yes. My brother saw to that. He said that he thought I should, that because I got better grades in school than he did, he was so unhappy about me that he thought I shouldn't leave the house because I was so unattractive. But that's, how did you happen to come to Westport?
Because I was married to somebody who had lived in Westport and wanted
mm-hmm.
to live here,
mm-hmm.
and one thing led to another.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to this beautiful house that
right.
we're talking about. Let's talk a little bit more about that house, or don't you want to?
Oh, sure.
It came from fireplaces?
No, the house came from about a mile away from where
I know,
was
but the different buildings and additions, so on, came from...
Well, just let me tell you a little bit about the house.
All right.
Because this alleviates some of my responsibility to document it on a piece of paper, which I must
good.
Do. But it was built in three distinct stages, and it was supposed to be built in 1720. The way it looks now is supposed to be 1720. I don't know who decided that, but definitely there are indications